Hi guys, welcome to the Fret Success Guitar Show. I like to share some tips and tricks on guitar playing, go through some gear reviews and the new things that are coming out, talk about the industry in general, interviews with people in the industry, and just some general chit-chat. So here we go. Hi everyone and welcome to today's podcast. Today we go through and remember Scott Hutchison from Frightened Rabbit. We also play some music from Richard Moss and Frightened Rabbit. And then today's guitar lesson takes you through a little tip of how to write better riffs using the E major scale. It's really simple and a great little tip. And then at the end, I'll catch up with Frank Turner and talk to him about a few songwriting things and a general chat. Okay, here we go. Okay, so I wanted to use today's new segment to go over something that hit me quite hard at the time, and that was Scott Hutchison from Frightened Rabbit disappearing, then unfortunately passing away. If you haven't heard of Frightened Rabbit, you should really check them out. They're kind of a stripped back acoustic with a bit of an electronic vibe. I'd only really recently discovered Frightened Rabbit just before he passed away. It was maybe 2-3 years before, and I really got into the music, but it was very clear that Scott really had his heart on his sleeve and was, I think, mainly using his music to get across some of the struggles that he was going through in his life. And it's amazing how many people you come across that are actually fans of Frightened Rabbit, even though they weren't, you know, the biggest band in the world or whatever, but just a tiny little band from Scotland. But they did play some big gigs, big shows, and play on, you know, the festivals, Glastonbury, etc. I mean, it's quite odd now. A lot of his songs are now tinged with a definite air of sadness. And then I just recall the song Floating in the Fourth being played, because that was unfortunately how he was found. And it hit me quite hard because, well, I've recently moved to Calgary, but I love South Queensferry in Scotland. You should look it up and visit there if you haven't. But he actually went missing. He was staying in a hotel just around the corner from where we were staying at the time. And I was so surprised to hear that kind of news, and we were actually in the area. So I can remember it quite vividly, being in that place when you kind of turn on the radio and listen to the news. It hits quite hard, these sorts of things. I think coming away from that, you can really see that in the music that Hutchison's left for us to listen to, there's a lot of real emotion in the music, and just the fact that he just wrote everything that he felt and put it into his music. I think people appreciated that generosity and his honesty in the way that he just wrote music. I know, sitting on the train and listening to it on a daily basis, it really just takes you to a kind of different place that other music doesn't take you to, because it has that context to it, and you can, I don't know, you just naturally, you do just see it in a different light. And actually, because it's around a year ago that he disappeared and passed away, that his family have actually announced details of a new mental health charity called Tiny Changes, and that's in memory of Scott. And this was all taken from a crowdfunding page where fans actually donated to that organisation to get it going. And even Scott was talking quite openly about how mental health is quite a reserved thing that people don't like to talk about. And it's great that he was talking about how it's important to do that, and we're kind of getting there, but we're not actually at that point where we need to be. Frightened Rabbit released a big stream of albums, and they were all very different, especially the early ones. They have such a different sound, a lot more demo type vibe, and you should really listen to the progression through from that to the very recent tracks that were released. They become a lot more produced, but also, I don't know, the story kind of stays consistent, and the lyrics always, I find, carry the songs. And that was just basically a tribute to Scott, really, because he could do that. He had the knack. He had the ability to do that and take people in to his mind, basically. And it's not just that, that they have great little memorable riffs. They might not be the most complicated, but that doesn't matter. As I've said before on the show, it really comes across as being something that's relatable and easy to listen to, but also it supports the lyrical ideas and the melody. It just seems to flow and work well. I find that Frightened Rabbit are an often overlooked band, and it's a shame that Scott died, not because the music will now stop with him, but also people are probably finding Frightened Rabbit now because of the thing with Scott. But the band, you know, were so good. They had that unique sound that didn't sound like anybody else. So as a bit of a tribute to Scott, I wanted to play one of their tracks, and I wanted to play one that actually was one of the ones that I listened to a lot. And it's just because I like the piece, I like the video. It all comes together for me, and I didn't want to play one that was, you know, a bit more on the somber side. I wanted to play one that was a bit more of uplifting because not many of the songs were, but it, I don't know, it's one that fills me with more happiness inside. So let's have a listen to that and see what you think. So this is Frightened Rabbit called The Woodpile. So I hope that intrigues you enough to go check out Frightened Rabbit and maybe Google Scott Hutchison and check him out and check his story out. So today's guitar lesson is taken from a YouTube video I did about creating better riffs using a little tip with the E major scale. It's a short one, but check it out and see what you think. And if you go to my YouTube channel, Fret Success, and subscribe, you'll get all the videos of that as well.
Hi there guys, it's Dan from Fret Success. I just wanted to take you through a little technique that I've been working on, and basically it's just progressing on the basic scales that you would normally use. So that's the E major scale. We want to expand that and open that up into more of a musical note, really. So let me just take you through some examples. I'm going to work in the E major scale because that's quite straightforward and basically a good starting point, and it's very easy to kind of tell what I'm trying to get across here. So let's just play through the example. I'll take you through the notes of the scale, and we'll just twist the way you think about them a bit more. So we'll start with the E on the A string. Move up to the F sharp. G sharp. A. B. C sharp. D sharp. And E. So we've got the full octave. But we want to twist that a little bit and flip that around. So we want to go up to the 12th fret and then come up from the bottom. So let's start again at the same point. So we've hit A. So as we know, the repetition starts. at the 12th fret, so we go back to the nut, so we'll play that A there instead. Play the B, C sharp, D sharp, and E. So we'll play the whole thing. Let's take that idea and progress it into more of a riff. So, easiest way to do this is to think of a pedal note. So let's play the E at the bottom. And we'll work through the notes so you can hear how they all interlink with the dominant note of the scale. So, I'm sure you can hear some notes go well together, some notes really want to go somewhere from where they are, especially like the seventh note. Very, very clashy, but it really does work when you're trying to resolve up to that point. So what we want to do next is we'll now work around that and play some kind of chuggy riffs just to give you a bit more of an idea. So let's go. So I hope that's been useful, and it should really expand your playing a bit more and get you thinking more about writing songs and get out of those patterns that we're constantly trying to play and develop some cool sounding riffs. So if you can hit subscribe below, and you can keep up to date with all the videos that come from the channel. Check out the website, there's tuition that you can sign up for, correspondence lessons, also private lessons over Skype, and physical lessons if you live near me, and yeah, see you later. Cheers, bye.
So later on we'll be chatting with Frank Turner, but here's a track first. We've played him on the show before, Richard Moss, and actually going to be talking to him on a future podcast. This song is called Green Grows the Laurel, and by Richard Moss.
I had a sweetheart, but now I have none, or she's gone and left me to weep and to mourn. Or she's gone and left me for others to see. But I'll soon find another, far better than she. Passed by my window, both early and late, and her looks she gave me, they made my heart take old looks. She gives me a thousand would kill. She hates and detests me, that girl still. The green grows the laurel, soft falls the dew. Oh, sorry, was I love at parting from you. Oh, sorry, was I love at parting from you. I'll change the green laurel, the violets of blue. wrote her a letter in red rosy lines. Oh, she wrote back an answer all twisted and twined. She said, keep your love letters and I will keep mine. Will you write to your love and I'll write to mine. The green grows the laurel, so falls the dew. Oh, sorry, was I love at parting from you? Oh, sorry, was I love at parting from you? Change the green laurel for violets of blue. Times I wonder why young girls love men. Oh, and oft times I wonder why the young men love them. Well, it's from my own knowledge I will have you know. The girls are deceivers wherever they go. Grows the laurel, soft falls the dew. Oh, sorry, was I love at parting from you? Oh, sorry, was I love at parting from you? I'll change the green laurel for violets of.
So yeah, it's nice to welcome Frank Turner here. He's agreed to come talk to us on the show. Frank's been around the scene for a while. He's been playing, touring, writing, release records, singles, all sorts of things. Hopefully we'll delve into a bit of the songwriting that he's been doing, what helped him progress as a guitarist in the early stages, and, you know, just pick his brains a bit. So I really want to dive straight in here and ask about your first guitar. Where did that come from?
My parents got me an Argos electric guitar starter kit for Christmas when I was turning 11.
Your first guitar being quite a cheap, nasty one, did that stay with you for a while, or did you kind of get frustrated and fed up and need something different?
No, I still have that guitar. It's actually upstairs in the house that I'm sitting in right now. I mean, it's kind of a piece of shit, but you know, it has a lot of memory for me. I mean, I basically started playing. My best mate, who I live next door to, kind of got a drum kit at around the same time, and we started playing together. And we were listening to a lot of stuff like, you know, Maiden, Metallica, Priest, Megadeth, Pantera, all that kind of stuff, all of which is really quite hard to play. So we didn't play that stuff because we couldn't. So instead, we played AC/DC and Nirvana covers, which is Which was much more within our technical reach as children.
No, that makes sense. I can relate to that, definitely. The kind of super aficionado technical stuff just kind of puts you off guitar a bit, and it's much easier to just delve into the stuff that you're familiar with. And
yeah, absolutely. Well, and I think there's something really powerful about being able to kind of like make sound that feels good at an early age. Do you know what I mean? And certainly, like In Utero remains one of my favorite records of all time, and a big part of the reason for that is that when I heard In Utero for the first time, I kind of thought to myself, "Oh, you know, I can make that kind of noise. I can, I can cover those songs and do a half decent version of it." And it was really kind of liberating in its way.
Yeah, it's accessible. I think that makes a difference to when you're learning guitars. Some people try and run before they can walk, and that's definitely something I've found through teaching and tuition, is that everyone wants to be a virtuoso initially, and then they sort of dial it back and start to think, well, what will I actually enjoy the most? This question I ask to people: how many guitars do you have? Do you have a room full of them?
I don't know is the short answer to that question. Just because I'm fortunate enough to be a Martin endorsee, and my touring guitars, and I play Gibson Electrics as well, but my touring guitars, kind of the way my world works these days, we have a kind of a rehearsal space in a warehouse, and they all kind of pile up there. So, and I'm never entirely sure quite what's there and what isn't. I have a handful of guitars at home that are very precious to me. I have a Gibson 1957 Country and Western. I have a Martin 1946 0018. And I actually have a D'Angelico Archtop 1942, which used to belong to Loudon Wainwright, who's one of my favourite songwriters, so that's my absolute pride and joy.
Wow, so that never leaves that room?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't even have any kind of pickup in it, so I couldn't tour with it anyway, but I certainly wouldn't take that guitar at all.
Yeah. So, in terms of, obviously you use a guitar a lot in your playing, do you have any specific gear that you could never really do without, or do you try and keep it quite raw, straight to PA kind of thing? Or?
I keep it pretty basic, really. I mean, I've spent a lot of time playing acoustic guitar in rock bands in my life, and there are certain prerogatives to hit that are quite tough to get right. I want a full sound that doesn't feed back, that cuts through the mix when you're playing with a drum kit and electric guitar and all that kind of thing. But I've kind of settled. I've got Martin guitars. I use Fishman or Spectrum DI pickups, which I swear by. But beyond that, not much more, really, to be honest. It's a pretty... The kind of fancy tech stuff I leave for Ben, who plays guitar in my band.
That's the way it works. I think that's good to have that kind of cutting through. And seeing you live, the acoustic guitar sound always sounds good. It never has that kind of... I think it's the Fishman, really. It's not too tinny, or having that kind of piezo sound that you often get with an acoustic.
Yeah, there's a lot of people, a lot of bands, a lot of mixes of bands that have acoustic guitars, and it's like the acoustic guitar gets relegated to almost being like a percussion instrument.
Definitely,
just this sort of like flappy sound in the background. And because my acoustic guitar is the kind of sonic foundation of the music that we play collectively as a band, it's important that my guitar sounds good.
No, definitely, that's so important. I know we kind of talk about guitar, but do you identify yourself mainly as a guitarist, or are you more of a singer?
It's just a good question. I mean, I guess I would, to the extent I identify myself as anything specific, yeah, probably more a guitar player. But I mean, musician, performer, to be honest, when I'm on stage, like, obviously I'm trying to play well and all the rest of it, but I'm also trying to engage the crowd and work the room and everything else. So it's all sort of folds into the business of, I would probably use the word performer first.
Okay. Yeah, no, I guess that makes perfect sense, really. Do you have any formal instruction, like tuition, as a guitar player?
I've had two very short bouts of guitar lessons in my life. The first one, my mum had a friend whose son was a guitar tutor, and I went to him after I'd been playing for about 2 years, and he just told me I was doing everything wrong, and then tried to teach me a bunch of metal solos, and it didn't really click, although I can still play the solo in the intro to Face Black by Metallica. But I hold my pick all wrong, and I was enjoying teaching myself, and I'm largely self-taught. I had a few guitar lessons at school, but that was basically a case of me just taking, like, as time went by, increasingly heavy riffs to my guitar teacher and going, how do I play this? And I didn't really sort of like approach it with any kind of discipline or kind of theoretical overview, should we say. I think about chords in a relational way rather than an absolute way, and all that kind of thing. And it informs the way that I play and that I write.
I think that's important. I mean, you can go down the theory route too far, I think, especially if you want to become a songwriter. And it's great to know the rules so you can break them, etc. That gets pushed around a lot. But
yeah,
in terms of being a performer and writing songs, I think it's just, you've got to just take it back and think, what do people want to listen to? You know, you don't you can tell by the fan base of these different kind of artists, the people that sing good songs and the people that are technically amazing. You know what people want to listen
to. Those two things certainly aren't the same thing. Yeah, definitely. And I think that there is a level on which theory can kind of roll out individuality a little bit. Do you know what I mean? It's like, because you find yourself not doing things that you want to do because you're not supposed to, or whatever, which I think is a terrible instinct if you're trying to be creative and write music. I mean, as I've gotten older and as I'm trying to push myself as a musician, which I still am as much as I can, you know, I have learned a bit more about theory and you know, I've sort of appreciated why knowing scales is possibly a good idea after all, and that kind of thing. I think having that kind of grounding and being self-taught is quite important for me.
No, I agree. Having been in more technically more complex bands like jazz bands and jazz outfits, when you play with other musicians that are non-guitarists, you definitely find that they very heavily rely on reading and sight reading, which I think is a good tool to have, but I think it also takes away that kind of improvisation and off-the-cuff kind of thing.
Absolutely. I actually can't read notation. It's the thing. I mean, I kind of just about figure it out if you give me about half an hour. You know what I mean? But it's not my forte. And, it's funny. I have a cousin who's a concert pianist and she can play Rachmaninoff. But she can't jam. You know what I mean?
It's insane.
I sit down. I'm like, cool. We're at 12 bar in A. Let's go. And she's just like, I have no idea what to play because it isn't written down. And that's interesting to me.
Yeah, I mean, I find that having recently moving to Calgary and joining a jazz band here, I keep getting given solos when it just says, just solo, improvise, because everyone else just panics. But I think being a guitar player, you have that inherently in you.
Yeah.
So part of the style. But yeah, I wanted to find a bit more about your composition process. I know you've got a book about it recently, but I kind of wanted to know a bit more about not pinning down a generalistic way of writing songs, but kind of thinking, what was the most memorable way that you came up with a song?
I mean, the one that springs to mind immediately, and it's a song that I'm really proud of, and it's not perhaps the most popular song in my back catalogue, but then, you know, my opinion about what my best songs are and the general public don't always align. But there's a song on my fifth record, and the song's called Broken Piano, and it's probably the most, progressive piece of songwriting I've put together, because essentially I was going through a kind of a bad breakup at the time, and my soon-to-be ex-girlfriend had a kind of broken microwave in her flat. That when it was cooking food, used to hum a perfect A6 chord, like an A sharp. And a 6 chord's a really open and interesting arrangement of notes, because if you hum, you've got an A and F sharp, if you hum a D in the middle of that, it becomes the D inversion. And if you hum an E in the middle of it, you're back to an A6 chord. And if you hum an F sharp in it, then you're kind of an F sharp minor. It's a suggestively open chord. And I found myself, whilst kind of whiling away days and sort of watching the end loom towards me, kind of singing along with this microwave, and indeed messing around with some traditional English folk melodies. And I really liked the contrast of a broken piece of 20th century machinery being allied with kind of melodies taken from stuff like Summer Is Coming In and Banks of Sweet Primroses and these old, very, very old English songs. And in the process came up with this piece, which is pretty ambient, and it doesn't have a time signature until the chorus. It's completely free form rhythmically, and when we were recording it, we did a lot of weird stuff with kind of like tape loops and broken guitars and all this kind of thing. It was really an interesting way to be inspired. That hasn't happened to me very often, being inspired just kind of by a chord, you know what I mean, and by a broken machinery. So that was definitely one of the more unusual bits of composition I've done.
No, that's interesting. Something that's never happened to me, I guess, maybe. And maybe I replace my products a bit more regularly than your ex-girlfriend. I'll have to get some broken stuff from the garbage stuff. Right. So I guess, coming up with melodies, you have quite a lot of memorable melodies when you play, but there is sort of similarities throughout your songs, I guess. Is it a natural thing that kind of comes from you, or do you have to work on them hard and hone them over a few months or something?
I think, generally speaking, melodies just kind of arrive in the manner of their own choosing, really. I find it quite hard to think comparatively about different melodies, and I suspect that there are probably some similar melodic motifs between some of my songs as a result, because when I'm thinking about melody specifically, it's just kind of finding something that feels good and that gets stuck in my head. The rationale being that if it gets stuck in my head, then hopefully it'll get stuck in other people's head too, you know? But it's just, they just tend to sort of arrive. I mean, once I've got the basic bare bones of a song and I play it through and sing it through many times, then I'll make tweaks to the melody as I go, I guess, or it will naturally evolve over time as I sing and as I play. I think it's quite good, do you know what I mean? In the sense that it's like, I can't really like analyze why one melody is memorable and why another one isn't.
Yeah.
You know, it's just they're just kind of like they're good and they're not.
Do you tend to record like melodies and then throw them away, or are you quite good at actively pursuing them once you've done them?
Generally speaking, I mean, a huge part of my writing process is quite mechanistic, and what I mean by that is that generally speaking, at any given time, I have a pile of melodic ideas kind of over there, and I have a pile of lyrical ideas over here. And in my kind of bored moments or inspired moments, depending on how you want to think about it, you know, you pick up one of each and try and put them together and see whether you can make any headway from that, you know? Mm-hmm. I tend to at least try, you know, I have kind of lists in notebooks and lists of voice notes, and even on some, at some points in making a record, I put spreadsheets together because I'm a mega nerd. But, you know, just trying to kind of keep a list of all the ideas that I have and make sure that I'm using the material that I've come up with.
No, so you kind of cross-piece them together and figure out which go with which, I guess.
Yeah, you know, and, like, definitely, you know, there are melodies that had a set of lyrics over that then got split up and the melody went to one song and the lyrics went to another or whatever, you know. And there are bits and pieces that started life in a different song to the one that they finish in.
Yeah, no, definitely. I always found, going back a few years, like the band Franz Ferdinand, when they did that song Take Me Out, that was a classic case of two ideas for me. It's kind of just...
Yeah.
Start and the end was like the completely different... Like, it just sounds like they've taken two ideas and put them together. But sometimes
yeah.
It's a great song because they just obviously weren't working as two separate songs and then just came together.
Yeah, yeah. I personally much prefer the first half of that song to the second half.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's... I wish they carried on with the same kind of tone.
Yeah,
they just obviously wanted to sell some record, get some people dancing. So.
Yeah, yeah.
So how involved in the writing process are your band? Do they get involved? I guess, obviously, you're not writing all the parts for them. They have an influence that way. But are they kind of talking you through different things that they would change with your idea? Or
Not so much. I mean, generally speaking, what happens is I'll write a song in terms of I'll have, you know, a chord structure and a melody and a set of lyrics and a basic song structure. And then I'll take it to the band. And usually when I take it to the band, initially I have some reasonably strong ideas about the kind of feel for the drum part or, you know, what I want the piano to be vaguely doing. But then, of course, at that point, the thing is I play with four really great musicians and each one of them will take my basic suggestions and fuck around with them and come up with their own style of things. So as far as the arrangement goes, they're an integral part of that process. And there are many, many occasions in my career where they've taken an idea that I had and made it much better. You know what I mean? Yeah. And thrown stuff in that I wouldn't have thought of. And like, there's a song on my second record called Love Worth Keeping where I had this riff for ages and I thought it was kind of okay. And I was just playing it around and in my head it had a kind of half-time feel and Nice just came in with a double-time feel on it on the drums and instantly it was like, oh, that's how this song goes.
Okay. Just lifted it up, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and just really sort of recontextualized the melody that I'd come up with. So they're not so much kind of at the coalface of the actual writing, and certainly lyrics are a thing that is very much kind of my preserve. But musically, yeah, you know, we'll definitely... The other thing is, like, as time's gone by, because we've been a band, the five of us, for over a decade now, we've got into what I think is, for the most part, a really good place where we try and, like, treat all ideas equally and let the song win the argument and try and keep all of our egos out of the way. So, you know, if we're working on an arrangement for a song and somebody has an idea, we always try and try it. You know, I maintain the power of veto, obviously, because it's my project at the end. But, like, you know, we try quite hard to be like, if someone says, what if we change key on this? Or what if we, you know, swap the verse and chorus around or whatever, to at least try playing it that way and once or twice and see how it feels.
Yeah, so being with them 10 years obviously means that you prefer that way of writing, performing, being in the band setup. Is it because you've got that feedback from people that you trust? Is that the main reason? Or?
I think that there's a sort of telekinesis that you can get with a group of musicians through playing with them for a long time. And, you know, I work with other musicians here and there, and that can be interesting and refreshing and great. But there's a tightness that we have as a live band. And there are certain kind of like, strides that we can hit as a group which you just can't do unless you've been playing together for a long time, you know. And certainly, you know, I want to have other musicians involved in what I do. I don't want it to just be a vocal and guitar project, and I've always wanted it to be that way. And you know, it took a long time to get the lineup for the band right, so once we did, I kind of held on to it, you know.
No, that makes sense. I think building, especially I find with drummers, that's the hardest thing, is having a relationship with a drummer.
Mm-hmm.
Being able to have cues from each other without actually speaking.
Absolutely. I think the old cliche is true. You only rock as hard as your drummer. Definitely, like, Nigel's a keeper.
Yeah. No, he's good. Definitely. But yeah, I mean, your recent album has obviously a noticeably different sound to what you would typically have previously, which I quite like. I quite think it's refreshing that you've kind of decided to switch it up. But was that a conscious decision to completely be more produced, or did it kind of just happen that the songs you were ready to put in that album were at that place?
A little bit of column B. I mean, essentially, the previous record, Positive Songs, was a sort of conscious attempt to kind of go back to first principles and kind of restate my mission. Do you know what I mean? And like to sort of strip away. And so when we came to Make Be More Kind, I really don't want to repeat myself in life. So straight away, I was just like, this record needs to be radically different if it can be. And then we did this thing on this most recent record, which was really new for us. And it was for the first time I had both the money and the inclination to do this, which was to not work out all the arrangements in full before we got to the studio. In the past, you know, we usually arrive at the studio and the songs are pretty fully formed. And a lot of the time that's just a financial constraint. You know, if you've got a week to make a record, you need to know what you're doing before you press record. You know, this time around we had the time and the money to really take our time with it. And it was really fun, and we started kind of messing around with different technological approaches, working with loops, working with more electronic equipment, that kind of thing. And, you know, and also the other thing is, if you arrange a song in a room with five musicians, you're going to end up with an arrangement that has five parts. You know, it's just kind of natural because everyone just sort of plays along as the song goes along. With this record, one of the things I like about it is that there are moments where there's only two things happening, and there are moments when there are 17 things happening. And it was just a case of laying down what the song required rather than what people felt like playing, if you see what I mean. So, you know, it was just really letting the songs win the argument at every stage.
Yeah, less of a jam scenario, like you mentioned before.
Yeah, you know, and just really, really just kind of being judicious with the choices. And there are definitely moments on the record where there's like three drum kits and a string section and whatever the f*** else, but which is fun. But there are also moments where it's just guitar and drums, or where it's just piano and guitar or whatever, you know. And it was just a case of picking what was right for the song rather than for the band lineup.
Yeah, even just having... Yeah, single snare drum hits and stuff like that. I mean, that's definitely something you sort of see that it's very selective and works. It gives you that kind of unique... But it's not like not trying too hard to be something. It kind of seems to feel right in a way.
Well, thank you.
It just sits well. I loved the previous style and was a bit like, oh, what's going on here? And then I just, it works. It works. Because you've got all those guys in the room that know exactly what they're doing. And when you surround yourself with such powerful musicians, it's inevitable, really.
Well, exactly.
So, yeah, even... pushing from that, you've got the lyrical style slightly different, I feel, that you've got the album title sums up great, but it's focusing on hooks and kind of advice to people, whereas before it was a little bit like self-loathing and kind of
erotic
stuff.
It's definitely, I can't stress enough that one of my central kind of creative imperatives is not to do something I've already done again. Yeah. You know, that seems kind of boring to me, and I think as artists have a duty to try and change what they do. And like, I kind of take the Heart and Positive Songs together as sort of two sides of a coin about a kind of a bad breakup that I went through and then the recovery from that. And once that was done, it's like, cool, I've finished writing about that now, and I don't need to write that record. I don't need to write those songs anymore. They exist already. And also, I mean, for the first time in a very long time, possibly the first time ever, actually, like, I've really felt like I wanted to write songs that was addressing the world as it currently stands. You know, I felt very bamboozled by politics since 2016, and I wanted to kind of say my piece about it. And also, like, I was trying to strike a different note. There is a place for angry punk rock records about what's going on in the world right now, and I can fully endorse that. But I just think that, you know, Anti-Flag can do a better job of that than I am.
Yeah,
and I'll let them do that. And I genuinely do believe that consideration and respect people that we disagree with is something that is in desperately short supply right now, and it's a thing that we all need to work on getting better at, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's easy to poke holes in things rather than thinking, right, come on, let's sort this out and work together now.
Yeah. We all have to live together at the end of the day, and there's, you know, it is entirely possible for two intelligent adults to have different views of the world, two intelligent, good and well-intentioned adults to have different views of how the world should be. And this is a basic entry-level fact of politics that everyone seems to be forgetting at the moment. So, you know, we have to figure out how to do it. And, you know, as a species, we will either solve our disagreements through words or through violence. And you can call me a hippie if you like, but I personally prefer words.
Yeah, violence hasn't worked for how many centuries now? So.
Yeah, I think that the renormalisation of political violence that some people seem to be quite keen on at the moment is a f***ing disaster.
No, that's not going to help anybody. So, yeah, I'm on the same page. It's frustrating. And to watch it from over here for what's going on in Britain is
it's
bizarre.
Yeah.
So,
right now.
Less said about that, the better, I guess. So, yeah, back to the guitar a bit more. I guess, do you have a song that you've written that kind of stands out as your maybe most technical piece, or one that you kind of are proud of as a guitarist?
I would say possibly there's a song that we released very recently on an EP that we put out at the start of this year. The song's called How It Began, and it's quite an intricate finger-picking piece that modulates key a lot and has some really kind of odd runs. And it's a song I'd written that I actually really had to like knuckle down and practice, you know, which is not a thing. Usually I write comfortably within my own guitar playing ability. That just sort of seems natural. But, you know, that was me kind of really sort of pushing myself into kind of newer territory, which I'm proud of, you know, and it's a difficult song to play, and I think it sounds really good.
Did you write the arrangement of the instrument first and then lyrics, or did it?
It was based around just this little figure that I've had lying around for years. You know what I mean by this? Could just kind of like warm up riffs that you end up just kind of messing around with. And it was just this really kind of delicate, almost like Baroque sounding finger-picking.
Yeah, so, no, I mean, that's interesting because your songs are typically quite very chordal strum patterns and sort of things. So
yeah. I'm definitely a rhythm guitarist.
Yeah.
You know, as they go.
Was it that you mentally thought, I need to kind of push myself, or was it just one day you were like, this idea, I'm just noodling around?
No, I've had that idea lying around for such a long time, and I had my day of kind of going, I really just want to do something with this, you know, rather than just have it lying on the scrap heap forever. But, you know, I do try and push myself. I mean, recently I've been learning bluegrass guitar, trying to learn kind of Lester Flatt, Doc Watson style guitar playing, partly because it's an interesting thing to do and I love bluegrass music, but I think that bluegrass is awesome as well as an overall kind of technique improver, because there's a huge amount of precision required to play like bluegrass guitar pieces fast and well, which is the thing. I'm not necessarily saying I can do both of those at the same time right now, but you know, I've been learning my way through a lot of kind of old trad pieces, and it's really improving my guitar playing.
No, it's insane. Fingerstyle can really take you to the next level just because there's so many different nuances, and it's quite encouraging. A lot of my listeners or students, a lot of them want to focus on fingerstyle, which is a great thing, because it's and actually stick at it, because it's quite difficult, I think, to do. Did you have any guitarists that maybe inspired you to do that sort of thing, maybe more fingerstyle?
I think probably my biggest kind of inspiration as an acoustic guitar player would be Neil Young. If you listen to kind of like the sort of After the Gold Rush Harvest era Neil Young, the way he plays guitar, it's this really kind of like heavy kind of folk and bluegrass influenced way of playing. It's very full arrangements on a single guitar. And because quite a lot of my early stuff, as much as I always intended to play with other people, an awful lot of my early shows were solo shows. It was just me and a guitar, and I was trying to write songs where I could like imply a fuller arrangement than you actually have with just one guitar. So, you know, doing sort of tricks where you're kind of like holding down root notes, but also picking out melodies at the top end of the guitar and all that kind of thing. So, and Neil Young, I think, is the master of that kind of thing. Not least because there's a kind of ragged aggression to the way that he plays as well. It's not very kind of gentle. Like, I love Richard Thompson's guitar playing. I think he's a great guitar player, but it's very kind of precise and delicate. Neil Young's a bit kind of messier and angrier, and I kind of like that.
No, I get that. And you can definitely see you're influenced by Neil Young. Yeah, I'd love that kind of style of music where it's just percussive and in your face, but also has that kind of complexity behind it that you don't quite notice on first listening, so...
Yeah, it bears repeated listening and digging into it, you know. But I certainly, like, I mean, when I was first leaving punk bands and starting to think about playing solo shows, I learned how to play most of those two records, The Harvest and After the Gold Rush, just because I really felt like I would benefit from being able to play his rhythm parts.
Oh, definitely. Rhythm playing, I think, often gets overlooked in playing, I think. Especially as a beginner guitarist, they're always asking me how to play scales and modes and all these other technical things, whereas actually I'm like, just get a metronome, pick a chord progression and just play it at loads of different tempos and loads of rhythms and just nail your rhythm playing, because people want to dance to music, but that's what it is, and they latch onto rhythm much more than melody, I think.
I'm sure you know this already, but like the reason AC/DC are a timeless band is entirely down to Malcolm Young. Like, that guy was the f***ing god of rhythm guitar.
Just playing like one chord or like three notes and just like rhythm just change. Yeah.
Yeah.
It just works. It's obvious. But it's often overlooked by beginners. They just try to get too technical too soon. And rhythm, it's all about rhythm. So what would you have done if you didn't go down the music route? What would be your, where would you be?
Well, I was kind of quite nerdy at school, and I did well in academia, as long as I was kind of paying attention to it. But I mean, I studied history at LSE and really enjoyed it. And the faculty there were quite keen for me to keep doing that after my undergraduate. But the problem was, by that point, I was already in a touring punk band. So I kind of had to make a choice at that point. So I suspect I'd still be hanging around in that world. I mean, you know, sometimes when I get asked this question, I kind of go, I'd probably be a teacher, which is true. But I don't want that to sound flippant. I don't want it to sound like I think teaching is just an easy thing to do. It's not. My mother was a teacher in state primary school for 40 years, and I'm in awe of her abilities. So I'd probably be trying to do something along those lines.
Yeah, because you have to be there to inspire people. I think just being a teacher for the sake of thinking it's easy, but to do a teaching job properly is very difficult.
Yeah.
When you have to be in the right mindset and come for the right place, I think.
Exactly.
Do you have any tips for like a budding guitar player? What would you say if you were kind of seeking advice maybe 10 years ago?
I mean, I think the main thing that I have done in terms of trying to improve myself, both as a guitarist and specifically as a songwriter, is to learn songs by other people. If I encounter other other musicians who don't have any covers in their repertoire, I'm a little bit like, what the f*** is wrong with you?
Yeah.
You know, it's, for me personally, it's actually got to the extent of like, I've done stuff in my time, like incidentally, ABBA are some of the greatest songwriters of the 20th century, and if you don't agree with that, you don't know what we're talking about. But but I've done that with ABBA, I've done that with a lot of Motown stuff, I've done it with Regina Spektor, who is a remarkable songwriter. You know, and just that thing of like, if you learn a song and learn the, not, and I'm not saying learn every lead part and learn every like that, but just learn the kind of basic root chords to it. It's like looking at a song from under, it's like looking under the hood of a car that you like. Do you know what I mean? It's just like, it really shows you how that song hangs together. You know, you just kind of learn stuff like playing that kind of major second chord makes you sound like Merle Haggard or whatever. Or, you know, you learn that Townsend's Ant has a certain turnaround he uses all the time. And you kind of get to see how it works because you're actually playing it. So I just think that sitting down and learning songs that you like is a really useful thing to do. And I would also say trying to learn them by ear is really useful. Going back to what we were talking about earlier, you know, I mean, of course you can buy the chord books and all the rest of it. But if you get into the discipline of listening to a song and figuring out what the chords are just by ear, I think that's really, really useful. And, you know, I certainly think about, as I said before, I think about chords in a relational sense, in the sense that, you know, I think of as a chord of being as a one or a four or a five or a six or whatever it might be, as opposed to being, you know, an F or a C or a G. And if you think about it in those terms, it's kind of like you get to kind of like overlay all songs on top of each other and see what things they have in common with each other. But yeah, you know, and then within that as well, just trying to push yourself out of whatever your listening comfort zone is while you're doing that, you know. I think that, of course, everyone has taste, everyone has things that they like and music, the kinds of sounds they want to make. But to go and to go and actually like try and learn some songs by bands that you're less familiar with, and that play, that use different chord voicings or whatever it might be, I think is a really useful discipline.
So you're doing that now through learning bluesgrass, I guess that's your kind of way of doing that. And that's kind of, well, bluegrass is, can be very, very complicated, but it's no, it's an interesting point. I think you're right, and I think actually some guitarists kind of focus on pattern playing like yourself, and then others go for the full notes. But I find if you understand the pattern structure, and basically if you learn the major scales and chords and you understand how all the other scales and chords relate to that major scale, you basically cracked it. You've got it. So, and then comparing all these different songs and just doing your research, isn't it, basically?
But I mean, it's just sort of, some people who I've chatted about music with over the years sort of have this idea that like you don't need to learn how other people do stuff, whatever, and that seems misguided to me. I think that it's really useful to understand other people's approach. Of course, you need to hold on to your individuality, you know, your voice and all that kind of thing, but you learn from the greats, you know?
I think ignoring that sort of thing would, I don't know, I'd find it detrimental. I think you'd progress a lot slower, and having a unique sound, I don't think you can do that just off the cuff and without listening to others.
Right.
So I have two kind of silly questions that I ask people on the podcast. One is, if you could go back to any point in time, what would it be and why would you go back?
I'm always tempted to say that I'm a massive, massive history nerd. I would be interested to have been around during the period of the American frontier post the Civil War. So the sort of late 1860s, 1870s, 1880s. I think that was a fascinating time in political history. It'd also be interesting to go back and try and listen to, I mean, if we're going down this fantasy route and like sort of hear what became the kind of traditional American songs in their actual native format. Because if you get into the world of trad music, it's quite hard, I mean, naturally, it's quite hard to actually know what transient music sounded like in the 19th century, and I'd be interested to know.
I'd never thought of that. That's interesting. Because, yeah, there's a lot of these kind of... No, that's interesting. Yeah, it's quite interesting to ask someone that's studied history as well, because I guess you're well-read on it as well. And also, the other question is, what is your favourite pizza topping?
You know, I'm kind of traditionalist. Quite often these days you can get, like, a kind of, like, buffalo mozzarella margarita kind of thing, like a posh margarita. I'll take the one of those. That'll do me.
Just cheese, yeah.
Yeah, basically, yeah.
No, I agree. If you get some good buffalo mozzarella, you don't need much else, really. And, like, cooked on a nice, thin, crispy base.
Exactly.
Making me hungry now. It's lunchtime here. No, that's great. Well, it's great to have you on, Frank. Been inspiring to talk to you on something, hopefully, that was a little bit outside what you would normally talk on. Maybe guitar.
Well, exactly. It's nice to do an interview that didn't open with the question, how's the tour going? You know what I mean?
So, we all know it's going well, and you're knackered, so it's like...
Exactly.
Yeah, so, no, it's interesting, because although you're not a person that springs to mind as, you know, as a person that would be in the guitar magazine or something, but you've got that kind of unique perspective where you've got this holistic songwriting approach, which is interesting to a lot of people that come to me for tuition, because they want to write songs. That's what they want to do. They want to get their ideas on paper and get them out to the world. So it's been really, really great to have you on, Frank. Fantastic.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me, man.
So I just wanted to end the show with a track that Frank referenced as being one of his standout guitar pieces, and that's called How It Began. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and here it is. See what you think. Check out Frank's music and also his book on songwriting that is released out. Frank Turner, it's great to have him on, so check this out.
Awesome. Thank you, man.
Dear Josh, old friend, apologies first. It's been an age since I wrote you. I know I'm the worst. Well, you know how I feel. I'm consistently cursed. This time I've found something. I think it could work. One day there she was, across a table, cluttered with drinks and slightly unstable. And I knew in that moment that if I was able to reach her, she might be my savior. Then she sat down, started to sing, playing my guitar like a delicate thing, her heart shimmering through the six strings. And I knew then this is how it begins. Joshua, man, you know how I am. Sometimes I can't help myself biting the hand that was feeding me love that fit like a glove. I'm my own worst enemy, please don't be mad. But if I can change myself, this can be saved. I can picture an ending as clear as your face, a path through the wreckage, back to my place where she waits to dispose of my fate. And she sat down, started to sing, playing my guitar like a delicate thing, her heart shimmering through the six strings. Then I lend my voice, and now it begins. Our voices rise like the morning sun. A hush falls like dust on the room. Like a bee's wing, my heart starts to hum. And I know for sure this is the one. This is the one. This is the one. She is the one, and that's how it began.
at.
Thanks for tuning into the show today. I'll see you next time. If you enjoyed the podcast, it'd be great if you could just share it with people that you think might be interested. And if you have any suggestions for future topics, just send me an email at learn@fretsuccess.com. Cheers.